From our studios around the world, this is Eat Well, Travel Better, the Business of Food Travel podcast. Every month, we bring you the world's culinary tourism industry professionals and share with you strategies, tactics, and information that help make you a more effective leader, communicator, and professional in our culinary tourism industry. I'm your host, Eric Wolf. Thanks for listening. Most people who have studied gastronomy tourism in Europe, and certainly in Spain, have heard of David Mora. A consultant, speaker, and professor on both gastronomy tourism and wine tourism, David has a noteworthy reputation in our industry. He has always had a passion for tourism, so much so, in fact, that it's hard for him to relax because he's always reading books, reports, and research about tourism and hospitality to better himself and his work. His passion, or emotion, comes out in everything he does and connects perfectly with the name of his business, Emo Turismo. And as a lover of tourism, what better place to live than in the seaside town of Getxo on the Basque coast? David, welcome to the Business of Food Travel podcast, and thank you for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So I've got to ask you, what is Emo Turismo?
Well, Emo Turismo is actually, it's just a brand, it's a name. Many years ago, I was working for a big consultancy company here in Spain. I decided to go solo and I thought I needed a catchy name. And since I was working a lot for Enoturismo, so for wine tourism, so I wanted to make kind of a word game between Eno and Emo, and I came up with that word. Emo tourism would be like a mixture of a combination of tourism and emotions. Since that time, I was reading and writing some posts on different blogs about that experiential tourism and emotions in tourism. So it's like my personal brand for the consultancy services that I offer mainly for tourist destinations.
Mm-hmm. So why is emotion so much important part of the tourism experience?
Well, from my humble point of view, I think when we travel mainly for leisure purposes, because when we travel due to business reasons, it's not voluntary. We travel because we have to. So we would like a mandatory trip. Therefore, we are kind of biased and we haven't selected the destination. So when we travel due to or for leisure purposes, we can go whether to a standard destination that doesn't generate anything special within us, nothing that makes that trip memorable. Whilst when we go to a destination that goes deeper into us and which offers such great experiences that create those emotions within us, I think that it will make us more loyal towards that destination, towards the accommodation we slept. And in general, as a whole, that experience at that destination will be better remembered. And therefore, afterwards, we will speak about it. We will generate that word of mouth. And we might even repeat the trip to that destination. So in the end, I think it's a great way to engage with a potential traveler and to make them the best ambassador of our brand in the future.
Did you wake up one morning and just discover, hey, emotions are part of tourism? Or was that something that you realized based on a trip that you took earlier in life?
Well, I think I started reading about experiential marketing. I don't recall exactly back then. I think it was 2012, something like this, a few years ago, that I started reading about experiential marketing. The first books from Pine, Gilmore, Ben Schmidt, and of course the concept of flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. And I was trying to implement those lectures on tourism activity. And we also started working for some destinations, trying to design new experiences. And I think it was like a natural evolution of the experiential marketing concept into the tourism activity. And of course, I wasn't the first person in Spain to talk about this. There are other consultants and other gurus about marketing who applied experiential marketing into tourism, but I just came up with that word of emotourism, and I registered it, and I launched my website. But of course, there are other who do kind of the same tasks and projects for destinations.
So you've been doing this for about 10 years. Were you working in tourism before, or what were you doing before that then led to your interest in a career in tourism consulting?
Well, I actually started in the tourism consultancy for destinations many years ago. I started in 1999, over 20 years already. I studied tourism. I did a BA in tourism in my hometown here in the Basque Country in Spain, in Bilbao. After that, I was working for a hotel as a front desk agent in Bilbao. And I took a master's degree in tourism management in Germany. And so my whole career has been devoted to the tourism activity. And as I said, over 20 years working for mainly for tourist destinations in strategic plans, marketing plans, designing new products, tourist products, also training services. So yeah, it was even before that time that I already started working for destinations. It's already a long career, but I still enjoy it. I have a great passion for tourism.
So you're Basque. Do you speak Basque?
Unfortunately, I do not. We have to, when I was a kid, when I went to high school, we had to study it, but as a subject. And my let's say social closest circles, everybody speaks Spanish. Now it's different. Now young kids, they do hold at the high school, primary school, secondary school, everything is in Basque. So now it's easier, so I do not. I speak Catalan because I lived in Barcelona for 5 years and I learned it and I still use it. But it's a pity I don't speak Basque.
Well, it's a hard language. I love languages, and I know it's a completely unique language in the world. And I started to go into it a little bit. And then I think it was that when I learned that there are 16 cases, I think I stopped there.
Yeah, it's hard. And I may catch some words, and when I watch telly, some simple sentences I may understand, but as a whole, I don't get it. It's a pity.
Well, it sounds like your career is kind of like mine, where you just absorbed with tourism and tourism development, and everything you do in your life is centered around that. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm very happy with it.
Yeah, it's almost like a disease. You know, once you catch it, you just can't get rid of it.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I don't feel like I'm moving. Like a couple of years, I was working more in the from the academic perspective in the sports industry. When I was working, when I was living in Madrid, and I was working for the Universidad Europea, which has a specific graduate school for sports. But the rest of it was mainly about tourism from different perspectives. And of course, I love traveling, but I have the passion for improving this industry. And of course, now trying to make it more sustainable.
The World Food Travel Association is the world's leading authority on food and beverage tourism. Founded in 2001, each year we serve a community of 200,000 professionals in more than 150 countries. Need help to take your business or destination to the next level? Or are you looking for the latest trends and best practices from around the world? Look no further than our upcoming Food Treks Global Summit. It's our largest annual event with delegates from dozens of countries. Visit worldfoodtravel.org and click on the events tab to learn more and register. Yeah, sustainability is a really key concept right now. And I think that the pandemic has shifted our perspective on what sustainability means. I mean, I think before, many people looked at it as being something that was environmental. And now with the economic crises of the pandemic and things like the George Floyd killing, we're kind of looking at how we treat each other as humans, as business associates. And people are, I think, are finally starting to see that sustainability is about the sociocultural impact, the economic impact, and environmental. So the triple bottom line.
Yeah, absolutely. And even a couple of years before the start of the pandemic, which it was like the final trigger for the industry to really believe on the sustainable future of tourism. At least here in Spain, there was already a national strategy for sustainable tourism. They were the national government and also the regional the autonomous communities. They were trying to shift from a mass tourism scheme towards what they call the quality tourism, even though it's not a concept that I like, because normally they link quality tourism with affluent travelers. So trying to change also the positioning of Spain as a tourist destination, also focus on climate linked or climate bond activities and more not so seasonal tourism. And definitely with the pandemic and now the EU funds are really linked or committed to a sustainable development. Every destination are now working on a sustainable strategy for the future. So this might be one of the, I wouldn't say advantages or positive outputs of the pandemic.
You're talking about the sustainability strategies and trying to coordinate them throughout Spain. And if we shift from sustainability into gastronomy, because that's obviously what we're focusing on, I am really surprised that Spain has not done more to promote gastronomy tourism. I think Rioja and Navarra kind of stand on their own, as well as the Basque Country for the food. But for example, in Andalusia, where I'm living now, you know, they have wonderful olive oil, they have wines, but they don't promote any of it that I've seen. It's all about the sun and the sand.
Well, yeah. First, we have to understand that it's the autonomous communities, these regional governments that have the competencies for the tourism industry in their region and also for the promotion. Even though we have the National Tourist Board that is called Tour España, which is quite well known in the industry. We have, I think, 32 tourist offices worldwide in different locations in the main outdoor markets. It is true that it's hard to reposition a destination as Spain, which has focused the promotion so much on, as you said, on sun and sea activities. Of course, destinations or regions like Rioja or others in the hinterland, those who have no coastline, they have to focus more on heritage, and gastronomy is part let's say, living heritage. Andalusia, of course, it's one of the biggest regions in Spain, and so many, is a great variety of tourist resources. Not every province in Andalusia has so much to offer regarding gastronomy. But I think maybe for the internal market, Andalusia is trying to improve its positioning as a food destination. But I think the northern regions, such as the Basque Country, Cantabria, Asturias, Galicia, and of course Catalonia, have a better positioning as food-related destinations. And towards the foreign markets, of course, UK number one, Germany, France, and then the US I don't exactly know how they perform out in outside abroad when they go to trade fairs or when they go to organize workshops and presentations. I think slowly they are trying to show that facet, that perspective of food and more as a heritage. And some like the Basque Country and Catalonia maybe linked to Michelin stars, even though I know maybe from the outside sounds like old fashioned. Maybe we still do not understand properly what the food tourists in markets like the US or the UK are really looking for. Maybe we have to make more research about that. That might be true, yes.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. When I talk to friends in Spain and ask their opinion and their perspective on the gastronomy exactly what we were just talking about, I think the Spanish are very proud of their cuisine, and rightly so. There's wonderful cuisines throughout the country, and the Spanish are very happy to point out the strengths of Catalonia or Extremadura or Galicia. You know, you as Spaniards can articulate all of these differences. But when you talk to someone from the UK or Germany or US or Canada or Australia or Hong Kong, and you talk to them about Spanish food, they will tell you, I've heard of paella, I know sangria, mm-hmm. I know about tapas. They may know that the Basque Country has some Michelin restaurants. And then you say, okay, well, what else do you know about Spanish food and drink? Oh, well, wines come from Spain. Okay, yes, that's true. What else do you know? And then they just kind of can't say much more than that. And then you talk to them about France or Italy, and they can't stop talking about those cuisines. So do you think Spanish food abroad has an image problem?
Well, of course. I don't know, maybe it's because you cannot find good Spanish restaurants in those countries. When I travel to the US or, I mean, long-haul destinations or long-haul outdoor markets, it's really hard to find good Spanish restaurants or at least restaurants in which you find like the real deal. Good recipes with original ingredients. That's hard. Of course, we have nothing to do against like the Italian, because you know, at least in the US, millions of Americans have Italian ancestors, and it's part of the American culture, like pizza and pasta and so on and so forth. So against that, it's very difficult to compete. So we don't have so many, let's say, antennas worldwide that speak out loud about our gastronomy. So first, we have to increase, we have to really enhance our international promotion, maybe through famous cooks like Jose Andres or international brands like wine producers or olive oil producers. And of course, also tourist promotion actions in media and online social networks. So we have a problem there, especially regarding those destinations that you just mentioned, like France and Italy, that are really far from us. So we have a big gap that we have to overcome. And so we have to invest a lot. We have to invest more, try to catch up with those big boys.
Yeah, and I think also when you talk about Americans specifically, and you ask them about Spanish cuisine, they confuse the language with the cuisine, and they say, oh, you mean mm-hmm. Mexican food? No, I don't mean Mexican food. I mean food from Spain. Mm-hmm. And they don't know about jamón. They may have seen gazpacho once on a menu somewhere sometime, didn't know it was from Spain, you know, couldn't tell you where in Spain gazpacho is from. None of that. You know, we just don't have that tradition, I think, where, like you said, with the Italian immigrants, at least people have a really good understanding of different pasta shapes, different sauces. They know that in northern Italy, the food tends to be more like French food with creamier sauces. Southern Italy tends to be more tomato-based sauces. These are things I think that most Americans understand, but when it comes back to Spanish food, I think they would probably be more comfortable talking about Spanish wines.
Yeah, well, I suppose because there are not so many wine producing countries in the world, so it's easier to, I mean, you can name like 10 and that would be more or less. It's some in South America. of course, the US, Canada a little, and then in Europe, and that will be it. It's easier. But of course, there is great food worldwide. Almost any country in the world has something special to offer. Maybe we have to leverage some recipes that you just mentioned, like paella and gazpacho and tapas, and then those who have the interest, maybe they will let's say dig in and they will go deeper into that and look for other ingredients, other products, and it's hard, of course. For Spain as a gastronomy tourism destination, we have to deal with the European markets like the UK, France, Germany, Italy, well, also Sweden, the Netherlands, and some of these countries, of course, they know better. It's easier for them because they are really close. Italians, of course, it's easier for them to understand. But I think US and to a lesser extent Canada are of extreme importance for us as a food destination, let's say, because of the size of the market and also average expense of American travelers when they come to Europe, and they are offered to pay for good products. So we have to really, really invest and understand better what Americans are looking for, and which will be the leverage, and where can we start from, and try to, as I said before, to catch up with these big competitors such as France and others, and especially Italy, which I think is way far from the rest of the European countries, food-wise, let's say.
You've obviously traveled a lot. Do you have a favorite food destination? And you can't say Basque Country.
Well, I'm open to anything. I like eating. I love trying new flavors. Almost anything. So I'm really open to any taste. Maybe right now I'm more into Asian food. I love Japanese food, but also Thai or Vietnamese and Chinese in general. So I think it's full of flavor, really tasty, different, very different to Spanish taste. Indian, there's something funny occurs to me regarding Indian and Mexican food. The more I eat it, the more I like it. Maybe it's the more I understand it, and the more I see that it's so broad and so varied, and really now the recipes that I'm cooking more at home, and especially those that I learned during the pandemic, during the lockdown, were Indian recipes. Like, I don't know, I'm trying to master the butter chicken, for example. So yeah, I'm really open to any kind of food worldwide, and of course I always come back to the traditional Spanish food, but even within the Spanish gastronomies, cuisines, different cuisines, I like almost anything. I eat everything. I'm not vegan, so I eat fish, I eat meat, anything. So I'm really pan eater. I like almost anything that even spicy food, for example. It's not so usual here in Spain, but I like also spicy food.
It's interesting that you talked about Indian and Mexican in the same sentence, and I'm wondering if you could explain something to me. Here in Spain, I've seen a lot of restaurants that feature Indian and Mexican food together, which as an American just sounds like the most bizarre combination possible. Like they just couldn't be further from each other. But in Spain, I've seen it throughout the country. Why is that done here?
Well, and if you go to those restaurants, you're going to see our completely adapted to the Spanish taste. In general, people in Spain do not like spicy food. So we don't go to, how can I say that, like very radical, extreme tastes. Like we are more into the mild scale of flavors. Of course, I think it's a lack of information, lack of education, or deep ignorance about those cuisines, or just that the owners, even though they might be Indians themselves or even Mexicans, they have to adapt to the market. Market in Spain still are ignorant about foreign food, excepting of course Italian. You're gonna find a lot of Italian restaurants. Also, there is some cultural appropriation, gastronomy appropriation, and the Italian food you're gonna find here. Even though, but if you go to proper Italian restaurants, you're gonna find like good Italian restaurants. But there are some franchises here that are somehow Italianized Spanish food. So it's we have to still learn a lot about foreign gastronomy. Asian food has done great lately. Chinese, Japanese, sushi in general, now it's like mainstream. But of course, all of them adapted to the mainstream taste of the Spanish market. So still, we have to learn a lot and we have to travel more. We also have to take into account that Spain is not a big outbound market. We don't travel abroad that much if you compare with other big Spanish big European countries such as the UK, Germany, France. We don't travel that much abroad. So, of course, that comes with time. The more we travel abroad, the more we're going to learn and the more we're going to look for international restaurants and flavors and products. And we will go to the supermarket and we will go try to look for Asian products and curries and stuff. So I suppose in 10 to 20 years time, we will be like in regular Western country in which we eat our food, but at the same time, we are also savvy regarding international food.
Well, I guess that's the challenge, right? Is to preserve your own culinary culture while embracing these other culinary cultures. And I find it interesting because a lot of destinations, the first thing they want to promote is their 150 different cuisines. And I tell them, I said, look, you know, if I'm coming to the UK or coming to Germany or coming to Turkey, I'm not looking for Chinese food in Turkey or Italian food in Germany, right? I'm looking for your local food. And they seem quite proud of it. And I think that the challenge is that it's the locals who like the diverse cuisines. They want something different, right? They don't want to eat their own food every day, but the tourism offices don't always understand that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also a question of generations. People of my age and older, we are extremely reluctant to eat something not so usual to us. Of course, those who travel more, they will be more open to international food. But as a whole, in general, people stick to the well-known tastes of Spanish food and Italian, Portuguese. But you won't find no Portuguese restaurants in Spain in general. Maybe, of course, Madrid, Barcelona, but the rest of the country, we eat Spanish omelette, we eat the gazpacho, our recipe. So it's gonna, with the new generations, we are also completely open to international trends through social networks. I suppose they are more open to international food. And of course, hamburgers in Spain in the last, I would say even 10 years are doing great. You have more and more burger joints and there's a hype about burgers in Spain. Especially if you go to Madrid, for example, you're going to find a lot of international, American, and also local burger franchise and also local companies. So it's burger and hot dogs, but especially premium burgers and gourmet burgers are doing great right now in Spain.
I've noticed that. Yes, as an American, we like our hamburgers, and finally, I can get a good hamburger in Spain. That's nice.
Yeah.
So, what are you reading now?
Well, you mean like for fun or professional?
Yeah, no. What do you read for fun, or are you reading anything for fun right now?
No. The thing, I don't know. There was a problem with me when during lockdown. I was trying to read like normal books, like thrillers and historic novels, but I couldn't really concentrate. It was I don't know, something weird happened to me. Of course, I was reading a lot, and I read a lot about the tourism industry. blogs, and also I listen to podcasts. And right now I'm sitting on my working table, and all I can see, first, I have a lot of brochures from different destinations. I have a lot of brochures from wine cellars. So technical content, and something that I picked the other day in Fituras, you know, last week we had the International Tourism Fair in Madrid. I have like a leaflet here from CaixaBank, from one of our bigger banks. There's a department that is called CaixaBank Research. First quarter of the year, recovery beyond the new pandemic wave, let's say. So I read a lot about tourism. So I'm not, sorry to disappoint you, but I don't really read anything that it's not about tourism. I'm very boring about that.
Do you have a quote that you're known for?
A kind of a definition about what an experience is. I made kind of a literal translation of from a German psychologist, and so it's kind of a definition, and I use it very often about what an experience is. And I say that an experience it's something that, and I'm trying to literally translate from Spanish, something that. It's not something that we experience on a daily basis that leaves a positive impact and will be remembered like forever, something like this. It's this definition quote in Spanish is something that I use very often, especially when I do some kind of speech or lecture. I use it very often, but because I think, especially if you if you pronounce it right and you explain it right, it's easy to remember, easy to understand what and how to apply it to the tourism industry and how to apply it to a tourist experience. So that would be the sentence that I have pronounced many times in the last 10 years, I would say.
So, David, do you have a quote that you're known for?
There is a quote that resonates in me. That doesn't mean that I use it, that I loudly speak about it, but the phrase or the concept of memento mori that comes from the Stoics, as you may know, the Stoic philosophy, the Stoic perspective of life has grown in acceptance in the last years, and I read a couple of books about Stoicism. This phrase of memento mori, I think especially when you are in the second half of your life, you are more aware that time's ticking and time's going faster and faster, and you have to make the most of it. So memento mori, I have no tattoos, but I might tattoo that on my body. So I think that sentence of, or that motto of memento mori is really, there is a bond of that philosophy with traveling. I think traveling is great to fully enjoy, to try to take advantage of our time on the earth, and during our trips we can really enjoy life. So why not remember that we are gonna die? That would be the translation of memento mori, while traveling, until our body says stop.
Well, let's just hope that we have many more years of travel ahead of us. There's still some places that I'd like to go that I haven't been yet. Speaking of which, where have you not yet been that you'd like to go?
Well, many places. I've traveled not as much as I would like, but I am also now more aware of the impact of traveling, and try to cut on emissions. And of course, flying until the airlines find out or do some more research about more sustainable fuel. I think I would like to go again to Japan because I loved it. I wasn't lost in translation, but I got a cultural shock when I was there, a positive shock, let's say. I loved it. And of course, the food in Japan is great. I would love to go to Iceland. This summer, I went to Norway. I would like to repeat, but I also heard things about Iceland. And also to the US, I would like to drive from the east to the west coast. That would be that coast to coast road trip. That is something that I hope I can do when I retire. Those destinations are currently top of mind.
Okay, well, when you're ready for your US trip, let me know and I'll give you some pointers.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you very much.
David, as we're wrapping up here, I always like to ask our guests if they have a particular pet peeve in business or in life. I'm sure you have one, I've got one, everyone has one. What would be your one pet peeve that really gets on your nerves?
Well, I think it's bad manners. Bad manners in daily life, something that really annoys me. People who are very noisy, who don't pay attention to the others that are around them. And that's something that even worse when we travel. Those who do not know how to behave, how to respect local communities, local cultures, who do not respect the customs of the destination, that really, really annoys me. And also I think it's part of the act of traveling to respect those who live there, respect their culture, and try to adapt and try to understand as much as possible. So bad manners when we travel, that's something that really, really, really annoys me a lot.
I couldn't agree with you more. It is something that also bothers me. And I think that when we travel, we should consider ourselves guests of the destination, not tourists, but guests of someone else's home.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, David, thank you for your time today. It's been a very interesting conversation. I look forward to the next time that we can get together in person. I think we share a lot of the similar values. So look forward to future conversations with you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Glad to be here. And hello to all the community and congratulations for all the work that you have been doing in the last years.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you very much. Take care.
That's it for this episode of the Eat Well, Travel Better podcast. This episode is brought to you by the World Food Travel Association. The World Food Travel Association is the world's leading authority on food and beverage tourism. Founded in 2001, each year we serve a community of 200,000 professionals in more than 150 countries. Thinking about a career change because of the pandemic, or looking to improve your current skills? Consider our bespoke training and certification programs in culinary tourist guiding, culinary tour operations, restaurant and food service, and culinary destination marketing. Visit academy.worldfoodtravel.org to learn more and get started. Finally, we'd like to hear from you regarding the podcast. We invite you to share your ideas, questions, and thoughts by emailing us at help@worldfoodtravel.org, or you can connect with us and comment about the episode on major social media platforms. Special thanks to our guest, David Mora, and thanks to you for joining us. I'm Eric Wolf, wishing you a safe, happy, and productive month ahead.